WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
At 33, Leanne Schreiber became the first woman sports editor of the New York Times. By 40, she had left daily journalism and was living the life of a freelance writer in rural upstate New York. It was also the time she learned that her mother had pancreatic cancer. From the time of the diagnosis until her mother's death 18 months later, Leanne kept a journal. Her memoir, Midstream, is drawn from these journal entries.
I have never been able to stand the sight of Mom in pain. I respond to it bodily. If she burns her hand on the iron, I wince. If she coughs, my chest heaves. Once, when we were shopping together in downtown Evanston, Mom tripped on a crack in the sidewalk and smashed headfirst into the pavement. My whole body started tingling, and when I saw the fright in her eyes, I almost fainted. The right half of her face looked broken, caved in, and I lied when she asked me if there was a mirror in the shoe store where we waited for an ambulance. I remember the effort I made to keep looking at her as if there was nothing wrong, as if her beauty was intact. I have witnessed only a few rare accidents based over decades of her healthy life. I have never had to repress or even think about my body's impulsive identification with hers. How will I react now that the threats to her are so much more extreme? What help will I be? What comfort can I give if I am simply the mirror of her suffering? I wonder if all daughters feel this. Do we all have to go through a second weaning?
How did you deal with having to watch your mother suffering a lot?
It was, without doubt, the most difficult task that life has ever given me. And I think the first thing that I realized, I think the passage I just read was one that I wrote when I was on the plane from New York to Minneapolis to see my mother for the first time after having learned only days before that she had pancreatic cancer and had been given only months to live. And in anticipation, I thought I would feel as she felt, that the level of identification and vicariousness would be so great that if she were in pain, I would be in pain. But as soon as I faced her, it was just so apparent that what she needed around her was not a mirror, but strength, that it was almost an instinctive response. I saw my father doing the same thing. It didn't require thought. It was just an impulsive reaction to see her in suffering was to be there as a form of reassurance, to be there as a form of strength, to be there as a vision of a possibility of another way of feeling. And that seemed to be the most helpful thing I could do.
Toward the very end of your mother's life, when her body had begun to completely fail her, you wanted to get her to worry less about her body and to think more about her spirit. How did you go about trying to do that?
Not successfully. My mother was so determined to live. Most people, when they receive the diagnosis of pancreatic cancer, are urged to receive it as a death sentence and to accept death within months. She was incapable and unwilling to accept that judgment. Partly what's very hard to understand until it happens is that one can be perfectly fit and healthy, as she was, literally weeks before her diagnosis. Only weeks before they said that she had 2 months to live, she was walking up and down the hills of Tuscany with me, looking like a woman in her prime, terrifically physically fit. But fitness and basic health are two very different things. But your subjective experience is of your fitness. So she was this immensely fit, young-looking, young-hearted woman. The fact that she was 75 years old made no difference to her whatsoever. It was just as if I had been told I had 2 months to live. I could not accept it. She could not accept it. So she chose a very against-the-odds experimental therapy that was going to take immense courage and stamina on her part to withstand in order to have her very slight chance of survival. She took it. The mental state which was required to survive the therapy required such levels of hope, stamina, and endurance that were valuable at the time. But when it came to the end, when it came to the losing battle, she was incapable of changing gears. She was incapable of saying, okay, I give up. And I think that was very particularly her. I think it was very much the nature of her character. One of the things that happened to me in this process, and observing all the members of my family react to this extremity, is as I gained a fuller appreciation of the fact that there is just a bedrock of character that is terribly individualistic, that survives the ravages of disease, and that in some cases is most manifested during them, and a kind of just absolute bullheaded insistence on as much life as she could have, as many seconds of it when it got down to it, was part of just the basic nature of my mother. Mm-hmm. And as much as I wanted to budget for her good and my good into a personality or a temperament that could accept the inevitability of death and her own mortality, I was unsuccessful in my every attempt to do that. And as much as it was very painful at the time for me not to be able to inch or persuade or cajole her into some more peaceful acceptance of coming death, in retrospect, I very much respect her stance.
You and your father were both with your mother when she died. This was in the hospital.
Yes.
You and your father were smiling as your mother died. What brought on the smile?
What brought on the smile, it was actually, it's hard to define in her case, the actual moment of death. It was because there was a period of time when she stopped breathing that we thought was death. And her body became totally serene. And there was light shining in a window, through a hospital window, onto her face. And then we saw that that beam of light had landed at a point in her neck where there was this pulse. And the pulse was the only thing that existed in that room for a certain number of minutes. A body in complete tranquility, not breathing, and yet this pulse of life. And I can't tell you why we smiled. It was an instinctive response, and it was in some ways a beautiful sight. The moment that pulse stopped was not a beautiful sight. It felt like death. It felt like a spirit had departed, a person was gone. And it was a very different emotional, visual experience than that previous second. I mean, it was startling to me. I never could have anticipated the starkness of the difference between the moment before that pulse stopped and the moment after that pulse stopped. But there was, for which I am very grateful, that interval of peacefulness.
Mm-hmm. You know, some of the things we're talking about are really very, very private affairs. I'm wondering what led you to want to share some of these thoughts in your memoir.
The experience, I mean, I had a very distinct reason for wanting to do this, both a personal one and one having to do with other people. The experience of a family going through the terminal illness of one of its members is so intense and claustrophobic and extreme that the degree to which you're engaged in it, you are very isolated and separate from the rest of the world. And then the death happens, and the bell, it's as if a bell jar rises and you're thrown back into the world. And it's very hard to integrate the period before the death with the period after the death, because there is usually the demands of an ongoing life. You have to be, you know, back in the office or addressing the needs of your own children. I was in an unusual situation, for better or worse, which was that after the death of my mother, there were no compelling demands upon me. And in a way, I had the luxury to spend the time trying to assimilate the intensity of what had happened. So I went back to the journals that I had kept during that period, and I had not been thinking of them for publication when I kept them. But I went back to those journals and began working with them and seeing if they couldn't be turned into something that could be sent out into the world. And I worked for two reasons, partly because I spent about 18 months working on the journals, which was about the period of time between the diagnosis and death of my mother, and I literally almost relived day by day the whole experience. And by the time I had gone through it a second time in words and in imagination and by reliving it, I was much, much more peaceful with what had happened. And I thought that perhaps by turning these journals into a book, they could almost work as an aid to meditation for other people who have been through this process, who whether they wished to or not, ended up blocking it out because there was just no way to incorporate it into the ongoing life after a death. I mean, everything pushes you to forget it, to put it in the past. So I hope that people in reading this book would be able to some extent, relive an experience that may have happened in their own life that they did not have the luxury, as I did, to reckon with and assimilate, and that it might provide a second opportunity for them.
Leanne Schreiber's memoir, Midstream, is published by Viking.